everybody. I'm Radio Johnny along with Denise Miller, and you're listening to Recovery Radio on KRFP 90.3 FM in Moscow Pullman. Recovery Radio is an outreach of the Latah and Whitman Recovery Community Centers. You can find them on the web at latahrecoverycenter.org and on Facebook. The Latah Recovery Community Center is located at 531 South Main Street in Moscow. You can contact the LRCC by phone at 208-883-1045 or by email at latahrecoverycenter@gmail.com. Their hours are 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Monday through Friday. The Whitman Recovery Community Center is located at 226 East Main Street in Pullman, and can contact the WRCC by phone at 509-715-1111 or by email at wrccprogrammanager@gmail.com. Their hours are 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday. Recovery Radio's purpose is to share with our community how addiction and behavioral health disorders affect us all and how we deal with them. We also share the personal stories of people in and around recovery, highlighting their experience, insight, and hope for continued recovery. And like I said earlier, I am Radio Johnny. She is Denise. Hello, Denise.
Hi. Hello, everyone. Thanks for being here today.
And for this calendar for March, I encourage you to go online to the LatahRecoveryCenter.org website and see what's going on there. And before we get to today's interview, I just wanted to give you an update from our fundraising breakfast and dessert that we had last week. We raised $65,000. And that just shows you how invested our community literally is in keeping this program going.
Yeah, thank you everyone who was able to contribute to that.
Yeah, and the real cool thing, because now we have outreach in Pullman for Whitman County, the money that was donated from people from Pullman or Whitman County area is going to go to support the Whitman Recovery Community Center. And Latah donations will be going to the Latah Recovery Community Center. It's kind of one big wallet, but we're making that distinction just so people can feel good that their contribution is going into their community, which is fantastic. And today, our guest in the studio is Anthony. Hello, Anthony.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm doing okay.
All right. Well, hey, Anthony, why don't we start out by giving us a little bit of your history, kind of, you know, where you grew up, how you wound up in Moscow, what you're doing right now in Moscow, and then we'll go into your recovery story.
Sure. Yeah, I was born in Bloomington, Illinois, and my dad was a career military man and a doctor. My mom worked for a bank in HR, and then she lost her job in the recession. So when I was really little, we went over to Idaho and we were house poor. And then all of a sudden the housing market exploded. We became house rich. And so we just stayed here and we don't want to move because we're very scared. I went all the way through high school and came up here to Moscow for college, the University of Idaho.
And, fantastic.
Been here since 3 years,
been
I think.
Been here ever since. And I met you about a year ago when you came into the 12-step program that I'm involved with. Mm-hmm. And why don't you tell us how that journey started? Certainly it didn't start right when you came to Moscow. So start as early as you want.
Like, sure.
I was born addicted. No.
I don't think I was. So both sides of my family have a minor, very, very minor history of alcoholism. It tends to skip generations. But I started drinking when I was 14 years old. I had just gotten out of a psychiatric unit for other issues. I had undiagnosed obsessive compulsive disorder and was a depressive and was deeply, deeply suicidal and was hospitalized. And after that, I remember thinking, you know, if killing myself is going to make everyone very upset, then I'm going to need something to get through this whole life thing because it's going to be long. And so I had started drinking out of nowhere. We had an open liquor cabinet, and Yeah, very quickly I learned that you're not supposed to fall asleep with your ankles above your head. It messes up your circulation. So I woke up with my legs in pain pretty often, you know, once you do that long enough. And it didn't start pretty at all. There was no like fun, cute moment. Immediately about 2 weeks in, I would stuff like tiny little shooter liquor bottles in like holes in the wall. I had like one little panel I could take out of my wall, and I would stuff that full of alcohol. And I had my dad's old flask that I filled with rum, and big bottle of vodka I kept in the closet, and in guitar cases. Turns out I didn't know that in that little
box
there,
inside,
where you put like strings and capos. I didn't know that was for strings and capos. I thought that was for drugs and alcohol.
It certainly was in my case.
Yeah, so I squirreled alcohol all over the house, so much so that I forgot where most of it was, and because I hid it when I was drunk. So yeah, eventually, as my drinking kind of continued, it would go into spurts of I would get in trouble, and then I would sober up, at least what I understood of sobriety at the time, which is just physical abstinence.
Right.
And I would try to improve. I really would try and, you know, become a better person and apologized for what I had done. That's what I could understand as making things right. And then eventually I figured out, okay, maybe alcohol isn't for me. And then my dad all of a sudden had a mouth surgery, and he was given a pill bottle full of Vicodin, and I think it had some refills too. So he wasn't planning to take it, so I took it off his hands because I'm kind like that. And and I'd steal drugs from my dad's pill cabinet, and that's how I had discovered opioids. And that was really, really good, especially for what I was suffering from at the time of extreme, you know, scary thoughts. It was hard living in my skin, it was hard living in my mind, hard living in my life. And so I got to opt out at any time I wanted. And I remember I hid the pills in like this in like a DVD case, because I had this big cabinet full of DVDs. That's where I'd keep all my drugs, and I remembered exactly which movies were what. And so yeah, I had a little assortment. Eventually, my dad figures out that someone has stolen his drugs. He thinks it was someone who was over at the house really recently, and they were going to file paperwork to have him investigated and things like that. They're going to get the police involved. And then at that moment, I learned that, hey, maybe I should probably tell the truth. And so I did. I told them, you know, I stole your drugs. And I stole them dead in the eye. I didn't feel bad about it whatsoever. He was understandably upset, but they didn't get the cops involved. Because they believed in me. They thought, I could just turn it around and recover, I guess, just on my own will. It's not how it works in my experience. Because that turning around, that becoming a better son, a better person, was just lying, you know. If I got caught, that means that I just had to try harder next time. And so that's how I lived from 16 through 19 when I got sober. Eventually, like coming to college, you know, I was reintroduced to drinking and drugs. I had maintained nearly a year's worth of sobriety, physical abstinence.
Abstinence, yeah, sure.
Year's worth of abstinence through religion, actually. I got really religious and started praying and started meditating from what I could understand at the time. But it's not because I actually believed in God. I just wanted to get some sort of spiritual power, I guess, to do what I wanted to do and become great and fulfill my ego's wishes for me.
Yeah, right.
And
sure.
I didn't find it because I don't think I was earnestly seeking, in my opinion. But yeah, I came back and then I realized, you know what? This whole praying and being kind to people thing is really exhausting, you know, and especially all this lying. Man, if only there was a way I could opt out. How'd I do that? Oh, yeah, that's right. And so my roommate smoked weed, so that was the first time I had tried weed. And then I started drinking again and got right back to it. It always got worse, like every single time. And the consequences got more severe. And the periods of abstinence got shorter and shorter and shorter because it became way more available. And so I would go through my days thinking, okay, you know, what am I gonna have to say to this person for us to be okay again, so I can go back to their house and, oh wait, they have a liquor cabinet, that's right. And then all of a sudden I'd have a bigger apology to make. I was very big on apologies, but not actually doing anything to change.
It's a good way to point out the difference between an apology and an amends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's right.
Extremely different. But yeah, eventually I learned that, hey, maybe I don't truly want to drink. And I didn't, but I couldn't help myself at this point. I lost the choice concerning drink, I guess. And one night I said, you know what? I really don't need a drink tonight. And I went to a party. I was just going to go say hello for like 30 minutes and then leave. But someone handed me a shot as soon as I walked through the door. And then 2 hours later, I was covered in my own urine and vomit. And I fell down the stairs and I finished an entire bottle of Crown Apple. And I smoked 2 joints. And the room was spinning and I had my head in my hands, crying, asking somebody how all this happened. And that's when it finally got scary and it wasn't fun anymore. And time went on and I tried different drugs. I'd gotten into amphetamines and I was holed up in rooms and truly getting delusional. And very quickly, this thin veneer of normalcy was, you know, falling apart pretty quickly, and everyone else knew. And I didn't know that they knew, which was a very weird situation. I didn't realize how nice everyone was being to me. And eventually one day I'd walked out of my my dorm at the time. I was still living on campus. And a friend of a friend who tend to be the most honest, they walked up to me and said, hey man, how you doing? And I said, oh, I'm doing good. And I just bought some new clothes. And I said, oh, you know, do I look nice? And he goes, you look strung out, and just stares at me dead in the eye and just doesn't say anything else. And I felt so offended that I had no other choice but to walk back up into my dorm and get high for the next, you know, 12 hours, something like that, and get lost in my own little dark, twisted fantasy. And eventually when I resurfaced, you know, plenty of people were upset, and again, I had to make all the apologies, and this time I truly did want sobriety. I just didn't know what it meant. And as time went on, I, you know, kept failing, and it only got more and more demoralizing every time the abstinence disappeared, and then eventually the drinking just stopped working. I didn't feel drunk. I didn't feel away from my own life the way I had originally felt, and I was just stuck with me, and that was my biggest fear. It's what I was running from all the time. I didn't want to be in my own life. And then, you know, quickly thoughts ensue of suicide and reckless activity. And one day I just had enough. And I could admit that there was no idea that I had, because I had so many different little schemes along the way too. I'd forgotten to mention those. But I had no idea how to change. And turns out that's exactly what I needed to admit. And I haven't had a drink since that day. I met 2 people who were in the program. A program. They had explained to me 12-step recovery in general, what it is, how it works, things like that. And I didn't immediately start attending or working a 12-step program yet. I'd spent 6 months abstinent again. And this time I truly and earnestly wanted it, and I truly got a moment to see what my life was like, you know, without drugs and without a solution. And like the best day that I had during those 6 months, I had just gotten a new apartment and I decided to sit outside all day because I didn't have a job. I had just gotten fired. I sat outside of my apartment and chain smoked just all day and covered the like concrete block that I was sitting on in cigarette butts. I couldn't see the concrete anymore. And that was, if that was the best that life got, I didn't know why I got sober. And I got really demoralized after that. And then, but I stuck with it, and I believed that nothing I was doing before was working because I checked a lot. And I really wanted it to work, but it never did. And so eventually a very kind person at a different 12-step meeting had taken me to another 12-step program, and that one felt like a very, very good fit for me. And I met a lot of people who shared my story, and I stuck around. I asked a lot of questions. I was aggressively wrong, which was the plan, because if I'm so wrong, then that means someone would have to help me, and a lot of people did. And it's been nearly 2 years as of April of sobriety, and I'm very, very grateful for that. So yeah, things are changed like immensely since then. I'm able to sleep at night. So, yeah,
it's always a good place to start.
Yeah. So yeah, that's my story so far.
All right. Well, thank you. Yeah, there's certainly elements in there of my story as well. Mm-hmm. You know, especially like how you said, I kept hoping it would work, and you know, I kept doing research essentially, mm-hmm. and it just turned out the same every time. Mm-hmm. And that's you know, the old AA adage, you know, the definition of insanity: doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result.
Yeah.
So yeah, and, for sure.
And in doing all that research, I didn't realize how many enablers I had, because not enablers, that's not fair. They enabled me in the way that they kept me safe from my own consequences, but they very, very often made things really, really easy for me to succeed. So I thought everything was going fine because I was still succeeding, when in reality, everyone else was nudging me along the way. And when it comes to taking responsibility for your actions and going about, you know, making things right with others and doing that amends process, especially, it's been a cornerstone of my sobriety to realize and actively encourage people to, one, be honest about how I'm interacting with their lives and how I can be better, and also, you know, understanding that, you know, within myself, how much I can actually do.
Yeah, not only how I can be a contributing member of society, but, you know, can you help me out here in these areas where I'm a little rough?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I read a thing the other day that said, in a world where you can be anything you want, a jerk seems an odd choice. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
And just because I got sober didn't mean I instantly stopped being a jerk.
Oh. I mean, you know, what happens when you sober up a drunk horse thief?
Right.
You get a sober horse thief.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, that's good stuff, Denise.
Yeah, I was going to say, as there was just a lot of things that sparked thought and like in things in my own experiences or things that I've watched with others. And when you had talked about struggling, it sounded like you were struggling with suicidal ideation when you were younger, having some mental health issues, and you spoke of coming out of the hospital and about people would be really upset, you know, if you took your life and you were just trying to figure out how you could exist in this world, because it was going to be a really long time. And I think that strikes a chord in a lot of ways, but for me personally, it makes me remember why it was I continued to use opiates and different kinds of things for my pain or for my emotions. And for me, it was a lot about like, how am I going to get through the work week with the pain that I'm having from my spine? Or how am I going to be able to have this conversation that my spouse wants to have, because he always wants to have them late at night? How am I, you know, all these different kinds of things where I was trying to meet the needs of myself, but a lot about of others and like my responsibilities or what I thought I needed to do. And then I was, you know, using opiates to cover up pain or to stay awake longer or to be able to, you know, do this or that. And really all it did eventually was tear me down and cause problems in all those relationships. But initially, like a lot of my choices in that were to show up, quote, better in those relationships, or at least the best that I could figure out how. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a good way. And so now I deal with things differently, but retrospectively, looking back, it reminded me of that and kind of brought that to light a little bit more as you shared. I think even in that instance, more than I realized initially. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. I, yeah. I, that's like, that was my plight as an alcoholic and a drug addict. You know, I was always wondering, you know, what do you want from me? Mm-hmm. Because you ask me to be here, I'm here, and you're mad that, you know, I needed to have a drink so I could be able to unwind,
right.
So I could be able to be nice to these people or do this because, you know, mm-hmm. without, I've spent a lot of time with a drinking problem and with a drug problem, but I've spent a very intimate and a very long amount of time with just a living problem, right. of just having to respond to my own life. And in reality, what I found that people have wanted is they've just kind of wanted me to try my best or, you know, or just to be honest. Like, I remember my mom, I was like a year sober, and she asked me, hey, you know, where were you? I was staying at their house at the time, and I lied about where I was and who I was with. I wasn't doing anything bad. I think I just said I was at a different coffee shop with a different friend that I thought she liked more. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it would sound better to her. Mm-hmm. And she goes, well, I know that's not true. Like, I know that's not true. I don't remember why she knew, but she knew. And then I told her the truth of who I was with and where I was at. And she was like, I don't care that you were with them. I really don't. Mm-hmm. I'm just mad that you lie. I don't know why you do this. Which goes back to that old aphorism of like, I lied when telling the truth would suit me better.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Something else you mentioned, and Denise brought it up, about suicidal ideation. I think I thought more about suicide in sobriety than I ever did, you know, prior to that, because, you know, I had this magical formula of, you know, these drugs and alcohol to, you know, get out of that space in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Basically not get out of it, but shove it so far back that it wasn't an issue anymore.
Sure.
But, but once you eliminate all that stuff, then what happens? You know, I guess I was fortunate that when I finally put the plug in the jug, literally, that I had seen somebody, actually my mother, go into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and get sober and stay sober the last 10 years of her life.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was lucky that I didn't spend days, months, years running around what I like to call stark raving sober, mm-hmm. you know, trying to figure mm-hmm. that out. Because, you know, even with the program, you know, the self-loathing that I had to look at and acknowledge and make, you know, amends for those deeds, sometimes was just way overwhelming. Fortunately, Ninth Step says, became willing to make amends to people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Became willing. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to be willing to go address that potential grand theft charge from a past employer until I was mentally ready to do it, or at least financially ready to make the appropriate amends for theft.
Mm-hmm.
So, and just thinking about those things, it's like, there goes my brain wanting to get out of the jam it's in at that moment. And, okay, I can't use alcohol. I can't use drugs. I could die.
Mm-hmm.
That would eliminate the
need. Because sometimes it just feels so big, like there's no way that your brain can find an answer to all these things, but not living would be the answer.
Right, right, exactly.
Because it just seems like almost impossible. Yeah.
So having, like you were describing, being predisposed to those thoughts long before alcohol or pills or drug, you know, whatever other drug came into your life. Yeah, I could see how, you know, your short stints of sobriety, your brain overrode your emotions' desire to end it all through suicide, and rather, well, let's go back to what we know worked, even in the limited sense of it. You know, I can to this day remember the warm feeling I got from that first shot of alcohol of the day. Going down and knowing that everything was going to be okay in a couple of minutes, mm-hmm. you know, after the vomiting and whatever, but everything was going to be okay, feel okay, put it that way, because definitely did not be okay. Things only got worse. The lies got more complicated to keep track of. And yeah, I would, you know, I would lie, you know, and even in sobriety. My wife calls me up, did you take the dishes out of the dishwasher? Yeah, sure I did. Okay, well, I'll be home in 10 minutes. And now I'm running and emptying the dishwasher really quick. Yeah, it's like would have killed me to say, no, but I'll do it right. I forgot about it. I'll do it right now.
Yeah, I found that a lot of the suicidality that I had ran into before working a program and even while working a program, I've always been nervous about saying the word suicide. And what's really, really interesting is that in talking about it, especially with, you know, people who of a similar experience, whether it be an alcoholic or an addict, the amount of perspective that I've been able to gain from working with others and allowing to be worked with, I guess, has immensely, immensely helped me. I remember talking with a member that I'm actually going to go see. Yeah, this next Thursday I'll be seeing in a couple of weeks. Very excited to see him. But he was very important early on in my sobriety, and he explained that a lot of the self-pity that I was experiencing was my ego, that somehow I believed that I was somehow just worse than other people. Like, you know, other people could do the exact same thing as me or worse, and I could see something that was redemptive about them. But for me, I had to be terrible. I had to be the, you know, worst thing to exist, and I had to suffer for my sins because that's how that works. And I didn't read that anywhere in any piece of recovery literature. In reality, he walked up to me one day and he goes, "Anthony, so I can see you're suffering. You're doing a really good job, but I need you to get off the cross because I need the wood." And when he said that to me, first off, I was a little insulted because I was a really good sufferer, and and I enjoyed that idea. I enjoyed the idea of, look how terrible I am. But in reality, me enjoying my suffering has not done anything for, you know, working with people in the program, well, in my program, or people in my life as well. You know, no one really needs me to suffer. And in fact, they need me to do the opposite because I have to show up to be useful and loving, and that really helps to be of service, to be useful and loving. So, yeah, in realizing that I'm just a drunk amongst drunks and that I'm not necessarily the worst thing to ever exist, what was different? Because I only ever thought about myself and the idea that I'm not that bad and I can actually be of use to people was completely foreign to me, which is why getting involved and becoming, you know, friendly with people in recovery has been extremely, extremely, extremely important to me because I need to get out of myself. And I've had ample opportunities to do so, and I've been very, very grateful to be able to do so. So, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's the old story about the definition of an alcoholic is an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. Yeah, because our egos, they don't just inflate our positive attributes. They also inflate our, you know, negative attributes. And, yeah, get down off the cross. We need the wood. Yeah, I've heard that before.
I was going to say, honestly, I've learned a lot over the years about, like, how our brains work and about just the pathways and different kinds of things and what we tell ourselves. Our brain will find more of it. So if we're telling ourselves, I'm a failure, it will find where you are a failure. If you're telling yourself that you're learning, you're succeeding, you're growing and those kinds of things, your brain will find that. There's just a lot of different things that we know now than I read about, like, how our brain works, neuroplasticity, different kinds of things. This is really cool. So, like, it sounds like what he said that day kind of made a shift, and then you started thinking about that and then working on that. Would that be accurate? Like,
yeah,
when you were just like, oh, that really catches me, like it clicked that day a little bit, didn't it?
Yeah, I found that no one can humble an alcoholic like an alcoholic. because the war of the egos gets too intense, and so
yeah.
So one has to lose. That's not true. A lot of people do want to think about working on themselves as a way of obsessing over themselves, I've found. And I've done that too, definitely. And when it comes to just taking it easy and accepting that you don't have to be perfect all the time, and in fact, you know, the things that you may have done wrong or missteps that you've had can actually inform your growth and inform others' growth when they so choose to ask you about your experience, that means a lot. And where I messed up, like, pretty often in the program I so choose, is that I thought too much. I thought all the time. And, you know, when I got sober and I was in college, I'm still in college, and I like thinking, you know, I have books, there's a place I'm supposed to be at a time, and I recognize that pattern within, you know, the program I so choose, and all of a sudden I thought, okay, well, I can read this whole book, I can become a sobriety scholar, and then I'm going to make Anthony's Anonymous, and everything's going to be great, and then I was saying something really eloquent at a meeting. It was my second meeting ever, and I wanted to act like I had about 20 years of sobriety, I think. And this old man looked at me dead in the eyes and goes, "Kid, you think too much." In the middle of my share, and everyone goes silent. And and so I just, you know, I got really quiet. And when I got really quiet, I started listening. And when I started listening, I started learning.
Yeah, the old take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth routine. Yeah.
Yeah. There's something to be said about listening to other people and it taking you out of like your own thoughts. And I don't know, it's just it's just a shift in my thoughts and my emotions as I listen in groups to what other people are sharing. And then all of a sudden, it's not just all about me. It's this compassion for what other people are talking about. And like also the clicks in my brain of, like, oh yeah, and gets me thinking in the right direction. Or I don't know, there's just something really, for me, extraordinary about being in small groups. It's
Denise, you brought up something there, you know, and in developing this compassion for other people that we do in these programs, it's a side effect of what we're doing. We also learn to give ourselves a little break. We develop a little compassion for ourselves. We're not a piece of poop because of what we did. We're working on, you know, clearing out the poop pile of what our life was. And you know, it turns out if you quit pooping at the same place all the time, there's no poop to clean up. You know, it's a side effect that I didn't recognize for a long time, but I did end up you know, giving myself a break after time. Okay, I messed up. I don't need to, like you were talking about, you know, stay up on the cross and, you know, even without sharing it with other people, just recognizing it within myself, you know, oh, I can, maybe I should get down off of here. And yeah, working with other people, certainly if your ego is huge and in place and misdirected, not going to be too helpful to other people. As a matter of fact, you might even be harming them a little bit. But it's all what we learn. It takes time. And these 12-step programs are uniquely designed to deflate ego and encourage empathy. And that's some humility, something we get, you know, after working through these steps. Speaking of steps, the first few steps, you know, after the first one, recognizing that you have a problem, the second two approach an idea of spirituality.
Sure.
And you mentioned earlier about, you know, you tried being spiritual, according to Anthony, for a time. How has your spiritual nature grown in your 12-step program?
Well, it had a lot to do with the idea of not thinking so much, of not needing to know everything all the time. When I discovered that I didn't have to understand what, you know, that higher power is or what it may be, all of a sudden I was allowed to just find what worked. And that's really, you know, what I need. I just need something that works. It doesn't have to be complicated. The only thing that I've ever gotten when it comes to guidance of a higher power is that it can't be a human power, it can't be you, and it can't be Santa Claus. Meaning that, you know, you can't just ask it for a pony and, you know, $1 million and a Ferrari, and then all of a sudden that's what you're going to get. That's not how it works. What I've found is that I had such an ego when I was trying to broach, you know, like a religious training and like spiritual education, I guess, before I got sober. My ego got in the way very often, in the way that I thought I could access some spiritual power and all of a sudden become perfect, when in reality, that's not what I'm being asked. At least that's what I don't believe I'm being asked to do. And if I was perfect, I would have a really hard time relating to my fellows. And so, I've found that in understanding that there's a way to the world that I don't necessarily know what it's called, and that I don't need to know what it's called. All I have to do is kind of, I guess, swim with the stream, as it were. That puts me at peace. I simply just have to be in alignment with the general consciousness of the world. You know, people tend to drive on the right side of the road. I should also drive on the right side of the road, because if I drive on the left side of the road, everyone's going to have a bad day, and it's really expensive. So it doesn't have to be that complicated if you don't want it to be.
Right. A fellow was sharing the other day, and I'd heard it before, but, you know, he asked his fellow, you know what the difference is between you and God? Is when God wakes up in the morning, he doesn't think he's you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't find that the spiritual nature of most recovery programs has a requirement. A friend of ours puts it pretty succinctly. He said, I came into AA and they told me I had to believe. They just didn't tell me what. Mm. You know, that's for us all on our own to figure out.
And it's exhausting trying to be God. Exhausting.
Oh, yeah.
Exhausting.
Not to mention I do a horrible job of it.
Well, that's what I was told when I came into the rooms, is that when it came to the God concept or the higher power, whatever you choose to call it, what you need to know about you and your relation to it is that that is your new employer. You have been fired from your life for poor management, and you're going to be demoted, and you're going to have someone greater than you, well, something greater than you, to take care of you. You may even believe one day that that thing loves you and cares about you and wants the best for you. I personally haven't gotten there yet, but I've heard many people who have. I mean, I would be willing to get there one day. I don't know about tomorrow, but, you know, we're working on it.
It's a journey.
Yeah.
Yeah. I find great relief in a friend of mine, Max, Max Chaos, who reminds people regularly that the word God, that's a job title, not a personal name. Mm. So, yeah. Yeah, and for me, looking at it that way, you know, made it much easier, because, you know, I grew up in a, you know, abusive, organized religion, or that's the way I saw it anyway. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of good, faithful Lutherans out there, but this particular church just wasn't working for me. And it took me a long time to put that in the rearview mirror in sobriety. And now I refer to God as the God of my non-understanding, because I've never met anybody too dumb to build a spiritual relationship with a power greater than themselves. Mm-hmm. I've met a lot of people that are way too smart, you know, yeah. And I think you even shared earlier how you fell into that category. And I think we all do.
Yeah.
You know, who knows what's best for me outside of me?
Well, I remember...
And then I remember that's why I'm sitting in an ANA meeting on a Saturday night when all my friends are out two-stepping, I'm 12-stepping.
Yeah. I remember like really, really early on in the program I So Choose, I was invited out to dinner with another guy who, you know, he would come in and out, and he was still drinking and whatnot. And so he wanted to sit me down and talk with me and talk about God and talk about the program. And as soon as we sat down, he immediately bought himself a beer and cracked it open, and we had a conversation face to face. And he starts drinking and then gets a little belligerent. He goes, you know, Psalms is your problem. You know, just read the book of Psalms and it's all right there. I'm like, okay, sure. And then later on, he starts talking to me, and he goes, you know, I really do want to give my will and my life over to the care of a higher power, a God greater than myself, you know. And I was like, okay, you want to give over your will and your life? That's good. Good for you. And he goes, yeah, I just want to make sure I find the right God, which is the perfect, that's the perfect example of like addict thinking is like, okay, I need to get sober.
It's control.
I need to stop drinking. I need to stop doing drugs. I need to stop doing all this stuff. Let me just figure out God real quick.
Right.
A conversation that has been happening since the beginning of time. And, then I'll get sober. You know, it's going to take a month tops. No.
Yeah. I was just going to interject and say that it took me a good 40 years to find my relationship with the Lord and to feel loved and cared for. Yeah, and so that's really changed my life, to have my identity through Jesus Christ and to have a good relationship in that. But again, I was in my 40s. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say, Anthony, that I think you're doing an excellent job. I appreciate how much you're able to explain these powerful moments and in your story and about how other people were helpful in speaking into your story and asking questions and things. I think sounds like you've really come a long way. And boy, it's just been a great time listening to your share. I really appreciate you being here today.
Thank you very much.
You do a great job at articulating and explaining. It's really cool.
Thank you.
Yeah,
well, thank you.
You
for that, Denise. Now it's going to take me an hour after this program to deflate his ego. But
hey, man, I speak truth.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I just appreciate it because I'm one of those emotional people who's just like, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. I'm taking Toastmasters to learn how to be a little bit better at like public speaking and things.
Oh.
So there's some improvement, but it's definitely something on my mind.
Sure.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Well, thank you. You're welcome.
Well, you know what's on my mind? Wrapping this thing up.
Sounds good.
Anthony, it's been a wonderful conversation with you. Thank you so much. I may even continue our relationship down the road after this, but, you know, jury's out.
Okay.
And Denise, thank you for being...
They're having their fun banter here.
Yeah. Waiting for your email. You know.
Yeah, that's right. And Denise, thank you so much.
Thanks,
for sitting in and contributing to this. And I'll close it off with my usual, you know, if you think you have a problem with alcohol or other drugs, you do. And you know what? Maybe come on down to the Latah Recovery Center or Whitman Recovery Center and talk to one of the wonderful volunteers or peer recovery specialists or counselors. And
sort it out.
Yeah, get it sorted out. And that's it. We'll talk to y'all next week.
Last time I was sober, man, I felt bad. Worst hangover that I ever had. Six hamburgers and scotch all night. Nicotine.